So as Deacon Andrews has said, my name is Dr. Paul Hilliard. I'm one of the church historians up at Mundelein Seminary. I also teach in a lot of the other programs up there. I'm a medievalist by training, but I get to teach just about everything these days up there, so I'm a generalist. And I'm a historian in training, and I am absolutely delighted to be here to share with you one of my favorite people, which is Thomas More. So on this day in 1535, one of Thomas More's close friends was executed by King Henry's forces, and that's Bishop John Fisher. And so Bishop John Fisher was a close friend of Thomas More. They were both humanists. That means humanists, forget everything you know about humanists and just believe me for a minute. A humanist in that time is someone who wants to make people better Christian by telling them to read good things. And that's the goal of the humanist program. So Fisher and More, they're reformers. They wanted to make all of society more Christian, more deeply practicing of their faith. But Thomas More will join his friend in being executed on July 6th. So that's why Thomas More, unfortunately, has never been able to occupy his actual birthday into heaven on the calendars, either the old one or the new one. So the old one, they pushed him to the 9th, and the new one, they lumped him with John Fisher. So today is the feast of Thomas More and John Fisher, or it's the feast of just John Fisher. It depends on which calendar you want to follow. So, but how many people are familiar with the story of Thomas More? Have heard the story, or at least seen the movie Man for All Seasons, or the play? So most people have. So I'm going to try to keep the biography to a minimum, because one of the things that I love most about Thomas More is not his ultimate witness. That's deeply respectful. His ultimate witness of a martyr. He stood up for the freedom of the church against a king who wanted to control everything for his own passions. And there's lots of great stories there's lots of great inspiration in the witness of Fisher and More and the other English martyrs from this period. That story gets told a lot. I wanted to take our little time together here to talk a little bit about the insight that Thomas More had into life, sort of what made him tick, what brought him to that point where he could make the ultimate sacrifice, but really kind of More's ideas. That's what I wanted to share. The wisdom of Thomas More is the goal for today. So let me just briefly go through his biography, and then the goal is to kind of hit these few themes that I really want to emphasize in Thomas More, but then give you plenty of time for discussion. So anything that you want to know or want to ask me. So that's kind of the goal. So Thomas More, he was born to a lawyer judge father, so he had a good education. His father made sure he got a good education, went to a good school. He got placed into service at Cardinal Morton's household. All right, that's a really fancy way for saying he got to hang around really important people early in his life and preparing him for kind of upper levels of society. So the people were just discussing earlier, the traditional path to a career is to go off to a university, right? And then you get a degree and then hopefully there's a job on the other side of it, right? That's where we are right now. So back then you could go to the university and get a degree, that might help, but the better pathway to a career was to basically hang out near someone powerful for a while and then catch their eye, and they'll be like, you know what, I like this guy, so he can do a little bit more and a little bit more. So it's called growing up in the household of a person. So priests could be trained this way still before the Council of Trent. That's lots of ways that people go on a career. But Cardinal Morton noticed More very clearly. He said, this child here waiting at the table, whosoever shall live to see it, will prove a marvelous man. Why did he say that? Because Thomas More, even at a young age, was really, really good at watching people and figuring out people. He was a people watcher, and he figured out how to speak with people to good effect. And that, I could just stop right there. That's the secret of Thomas More. He understood people because he understood himself, and he tried to make them better. And that's kind of his whole life story could be told in just those few sentences. Okay, so you need more education though if you want a career in the 16th century. So he's off to Oxford for a bit. Actually, he picked up a love of Greek, of reading Greek and the humanities and the new learning, and his father was like, that's not practical at all. Sound familiar for those of you that are interested in humanity? Okay. That's not practical at all. So his father was a little upset about that, pulled him out, sent him to the Inns of Court where he trained to be a lawyer. Inns of Court had a great format for training lawyers at the time. They debated until they fell over all the time. Always debates. Mock trials. It's basically, if those of you that have done mock trial, you get to do mock trial the whole time you're learning to be a lawyer. That's kind of the way that it went. But more, he kept his love for Greek. He mastered it in 3 years, and he'd go on to be the best translator of Greek into Latin in the 16th century. During the 16th century, he was more famous for that than for anything else that we know him for. So he's a clever guy, but he's learning people. He's extremely happy as a lawyer. He becomes a lawyer, then he becomes a judge. He's a diplomat at times for the merchants. The merchant class in particular loves Thomas More. Why? Because he's honest. And so the merchant class really respects that. They send him on diplomatic missions. He's so well loved by the merchants and the people of London that they make him a member of parliament. So an MP, he becomes a member of the House of Commons. He gets married in 1505. He had discerned wanting to go into the Carthusians. So he's a man already of deep prayer, spent some time there, picked up from them daily prayer, self-mortification, a lot of the kind of standard things of the 16th century religious life. But he discerned out and he decided that that wasn't for him. And he's married, and his wife, Jane Colt, who he loved very much, had 4 children, but she died in childbirth in 1511. He immediately remarried a much older woman named Alice, who had stepchildren of her own, and they have kind of a composite family. And so Alice and Thomas would raise all of these children during his life. By the time he gets to 1510, you start to see him doing more political assignments. Like he's basically the under sheriff of London, which is basically the district attorney of London. That's kind of where he is. So he's climbing pretty quick, actually, if you start from where he is in his lifetime. He's moving up pretty fast. And because he's doing so well, he comes to the notice of the king. And so the king begins to think, young Henry, a humanist. He wasn't supposed to be king. His brother Arthur was supposed to be king, but Arthur died young, and so Henry, who was training in theology and loved Greek and Latin and the classics and all of those sorts of things, he ends up becoming king. There was a lot of hope for Henry at the time. No one was quite sure exactly what direction Henry would go. We all know the direction that Henry would go, but Henry comes to the attention of Thomas More. Okay. Thomas More is doing really, really well in his professional career. Why in the world would you get involved with the king's court? Right? Why would you go into service for that? And historians are fighting about this all the time. Why would Thomas More? There is one version of historical scholarship that says Thomas More is a power monger, and then there's the rest of scholarship which says he does it out of public service. This is one of the interesting, it's there on your handout if you see this line from Thomas More's Utopia. The Utopia, has anyone had to read The Utopia? Thomas More's Utopia, yes? Few of you reading about nowhere. So The Utopia is a book, it's a travelogue. It's a conversation between a number of different interlocutors. One is this crazy adventurer, Raphael, who went to the New World, because this is after 1492, so the New World's exciting news at the moment, went to the New World and discovered this place, Utopia, which in Greek means nowhere. So Thomas More is already telling you that this is fictional, right? So he meets this place, and it's all about these people who have share property, there's no greed, everything is perfect about this particular place, right? And they use this place as kind of a lens or a foil to talk about European society. That's part of the main text. That's why secular politics programs still read The Utopia today. There's even a statue of Thomas More put up by the Soviets in the Red Square because of this book. Because he's like, look, they got communism right all the way back there. So that's Thomas More has been co-opted by lots of different forces. You just remember, utopia is nowhere. It doesn't exist. That's the important thing. Because there is a figure in the dialogue who is actually named Thomas More. So Thomas More has his own persona in the text, like Dante puts himself into the Divina Commedia. So Thomas More says this, though, in the line, in the book, which is, if so, Raphael and More debating about whether kings can be fixed. Like, can they be improved? Is there anything you can do about kings whatsoever? And More says this: if you cannot pluck up bad ideas by the root, if you cannot cure long-standing evils as completely as you would like, you must not therefore abandon the commonwealth. Don't give up the ship in a storm because you cannot direct the winds. You must strive to influence policy indirectly. Handle the situation tactfully, and thus what you cannot turn to good, you may at least make less bad. For it is impossible to make all institutions good unless you make all men good. And that I do not expect to see for a long time. All right. We in the West, those of us that are children in the West, particularly Americans, they're children of revolutions. And so our default attitude is, if things aren't working, just get out the Etch-a-Sketch and just build a new thing that's perfect from our own ideas, right? That's not Thomas More's position. Thomas More's position, I want you to really reflect on that with me today, because there's a significant difference, I think, between let's make the world a better place or let's make things less bad, right? Let's make the world a better place, I'm going to kind of argue a little bit, is a little bit closer to nowhere, utopia. It's a little bit more fueled by utopian desires, whatever that might be. But let's make things a little less bad. That's a little bit more in line with the divine economy, how God works himself, slowly, over time, making things a little less bad. So I'll come back to that in Thomas More's wisdom. But this right here, the king asked him to serve. It's his duty to make things less bad. So that's why he goes into the king's service. Also, he's a humanist, and he believes maybe, just maybe, he can advise the king in such a way that there'd be peace in Europe. And so that's the other piece. Leo X had demanded in 1518 that the humanists would actively promote peace, and so he went into king's service to do that. Real quick on this, basically, he's brilliant, he's a great reader, he's a good counselor. Everything he says is wise. And so he just shoots right up in authority. And Henry just pours out largesse on him, sends him off and gives him one post after another until he's eventually Lord Chancellor of the whole realm. So that's basically the most important person in all of Tudor England. He has all of the authority that one could ask for. And he works especially, his crowning achievement for Thomas More, he said, was the Peace of Cambrai in 1529, which was peace between England and France, which France will break again and again. Anyway, so that was peace, and Henry will break pieces too in this case. Anyway, coming back though, because of the king's great matter, Henry VIII, didn't have a male child. Mary was fine, but anyway, he didn't have a male child. He wanted a male child. He comes up with lots of different excuses, and he's not getting what he wants. And so if you are a tyrant, according to Thomas More, you can't use your will properly. You're guided by your passions. Your passions control you. You lack free will. You lack the ability to exercise your free will properly. And so for Thomas More, he wrote about this a long time ago. He said, one of the things tyrants do is they always start picking on the church. That's like your first sign that tyranny has arrived, is when the monarchs, Christian monarchs, start picking on the church. So the minute Henry started bullying the clergy, Thomas More resigned and promised, I'm not going to say anything about Anne Boleyn, your wannabe wife. I'm not going to say anything about succession. I'm not going to say anything about who gets to be the next king or any of those things. I promise I won't say any of that. And he never did until he was convicted. He never said anything about that. But he wasn't completely silent. So Thomas More did write directly against the false ideology coming out of Henry's court about how Henry could be in charge of the church and the realm at the same time. And Thomas More wrote directly against that, which is probably why Henry got really mad with him. And then the trial, it's worth going through it and studying it in great detail some other time. I'm not going to go through it right now because I want to get to that wisdom piece. But he's basically arrested illegally, imprisoned illegally. People try to entrap him all the time. They can never entrap him. Basically, they have to perjure themselves in order to finally convict Thomas More of treason against the crown, because he keeps copies of everything, and he's guarding everything that he says. And finally, when he's convicted falsely, he does declare, "I will not sign the Act of Supremacy," which says that the king is in charge of the church, because the king can't do that. I have all of tradition saying the church is free and can't be controlled by one little tiny piece of Christendom. Because England's not really important in the 16th century. That's the other thing you have to remember. It's like kind of inconsequential. England's time is coming later, but it's at that point, it's not very important. Okay, off he goes to the scaffold because of this decision. And he finally will be executed on July 1st, 1535. The trial is July 1st and he's executed July 6th. Henry, in his great love of Thomas More, commutes his sentence to being having his head cut off instead of hanged, drawn, and quartered. So his last words, he was making jokes all the way up to the end and comforting people all the way to the end. He even made a joke about saying to his executioner, he said, "Don't worry, Master Lieutenant, help me up to the scaffold. I'll take care of it on my way down." So it's just the whole way through. His last words, reported by the equivalent of a French newspaper, which are right here. I'm going to butcher the French if I attempt to say it. But the direct translation of the French is, "I die the king's good servant and God's first." Not "but," "and God's first." So that's the report that we have. It's that "et." There's not really any other way you can do that. So, "and God's first." So what does that mean, to be the king's good servant and God's first? It means that Thomas More was trying to do something with the very last breath of his body that he'd been trying to do since he entered the king's service, which is give the king good counsel. He was still trying to remind the king of what was important: duty to God and duty to country. Not country over God, but both "and" is what he's trying to say. So with his very last act, Thomas More does what Thomas More had been doing his whole life, is trying to provide people with good counsel. And most people listened to him. The people of London loved him. They called him Mock More, because when he often used jokes to get people to listen to him. Charles V, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, said this about Thomas More: "And this we will say, that if he had been a master of such a servant, of whose doings ourselves had these many years no small experience, we would have rather lost our best city of our dominions than have lost such a worthy counselor." That's what Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, said. More knew Henry really well. And it's reported in Roper's Life, that's his son-in-law's biography of Thomas More. He says, "Howbeit, son Roper, I may tell thee, if I have no cause to be proud of the king's favor, because if my head would win him in a castle in France, it should not fail to go." So he understood Henry very, very well. But he still, to his last dying breath, tried to convince Henry of what was the right thing. One of the reasons I love Thomas More is because his wisdom is so penetrating and he fails. It is a reminder that truth, goodness, beauty sometimes are killed by the world, but triumphant in the end. It doesn't matter that Henry went on to be Henry VIII and run through his wives as fast as possible, from Thomas More's perspective. He stayed true to the Christian duty of his statesmanship all the way through to the very end. But he's a hyper-realist about it. Okay, any questions about my really fast run through Thomas More's biography? before I get to some of his core teachings I want to share? No? Okay. All right. So how did you get to be someone who could convince other people to do good, just unfortunately not Henry, all the time? How do you get there? Step one is always the same with the saints. If you look very, very closely, step one is always self-governance. It's always, call it what you will, humility, discipline of oneself. It always begins with the person at the beginning. So Thomas More was able to do this through his prayer.
Self-governance is the beginning.
Whoa. See, it's so important that there was an audio file left on the slide to tell you that self-governance is the beginning of everything. Teach me to recycle slides. All right, so self-governance. For Thomas More, the big issue is free will. How can you use your free will well? He is fighting tooth and nail with the Lutherans who deny the existence of free will. This is a very hot topic for him and very much on the forefront of Christendom's mind at this moment. How do you use free will well? One is get an education which inculcates virtue. And that's what he gave to his children, all of his children. He educated the girls and the boys, everybody got an education from Thomas More. He either did it himself or he hired tutors. He actually helped Desiderius Erasmus kind of overcome his misogyny. He's like, women can't learn. And then Erasmus met Meg More. And he's like, oh, never mind. So he changed his mind. So what point of an education, though, is to inculcate virtue. Virtue first, knowledge second. This is how he prioritized education. But the key really is, and this is why it's the snake, don't listen to the snake. The key for using your free will well is remembering you are a creature. That's it. What does that mean, to remember you are a creature? It means you're not in charge of everything, right? Your goal is to make things less bad. There's one point that Thomas More is talking about what's the best form of government. And he's like, well, probably representational government, but if I could make that decision, it means we're in a monarchy, right? If I'm the one who's going to impose everything. So More has this, he has this very deep realism to him. And the one that keeps him grounded is the memory that he's a creature. Both the glory of that, being a creature of God, being a creation of God, and the limitation of that, a fallen one as well. So remembering one's creatureliness and one's fallenness is absolutely essential. One way that More gets this across really well, which is what I like, is his discussion of pride. Pride is a process for Thomas More. Here is how it goes. The first thing that you get hit with is flattery. Like, you did a good job. And you're like, oh, okay, good. I did a good job. You see that phrase? I did a good job? Now, start emphasizing the I at the beginning. I did a good job, right? Something good happened and I did it, right? So this is mine. This is my thing that I did. God has nothing to do with this, right? And now what have I just done? I've stolen from God. I've stolen the goodness of the action from God himself to say that I am the author of it. And then finally, oh, you know what? God had absolutely nothing to do with it. I did everything of this on my own. God is excluded from this action. What has just happened? You've now moved into the place of Satan. You're in open rebellion against God. You are denying your creatureliness. It's a slow process. It begins, that's why he calls flattery venom. It begins as a process where you take ownership over what's not yours. You forget your creaturely status or your creaturely position. And so if you do that, it's very easy to start to give in to making everything operate according to the fantasy of your own making, right? A creature has to accept the reality of the creator. But if you rebel against the creator, then you create, instead, you can operate according to fantasies of your own making. And we all have that, right? We don't even need to go fish up ideologies that are out there in the world in order to come across fantasies of our own making. So how do you resist becoming like Henry, being trapped by your passions and your fantasies of your own making? Remember your creatureliness. So it leads to helping you to self-govern. With that deep level of personal knowledge of himself, he also added a deep knowledge of people as well. Where did he get this from? He watched them. He knew himself. He knew the reality of what it meant to be a creature who is both fallen and bearing the image and likeness of God. But he also watched people and listened to them, really listened to them to hear what they were trying to say, to try to get under what they're trying to say, because he has that good lawyer mind, right? So it's you try to hear the deeper things that are going on so you can resolve the issues. But also, of course, I would say this, he studied poetry and the orators and histories. He read the classics to learn about how people work. That's one of the great things about literature. Literature does a lot of what philosophy can do in a lot faster and a much more entertaining way, right? So it's not always perfectly, but it can reveal a lot about human beings, and it can do it in a very insightful way. Even occasionally movies and things like that could do it too. But for more, it was study the great poets, the orators, and the historians. One of the best Thomas More scholars, his name is Gerald Wegemer. So he is a fantastic reader of Thomas More, a great sensitive scholar to it. He himself wanted to be a philosopher because he loved truth, and he wanted to teach people truth. But because he studied Thomas More, he realized that the best way to teach people truth was to become a literature professor. This is back in a day when, you know, humanities were funded. So he could become a literature professor in order to teach people the truth. He learned this lesson from Thomas More, and he's still doing it to this day. Okay, so know people. Know them in their motivations, know them in their desires, know them that they're fallen, but know them in their goodness, right? So you have to apply the same level of depth of knowledge that you do to yourself to those you interact with. And if you can do that, then you're much more set up to provide good counsel. Right? The truth is beautiful, right? The truth that the Catholic Church presents to us is a beautiful thing. And if I stand up on this chair and shout out this truth, it'll work really well probably in this room. Right? Because most of you are here because you think the Catholic Church might have something good to tell us all, right? But is that going to be very effective if I take this over and put it on Western Avenue and stand up and start shouting? I don't know, do you have brickyard preachers in Chicago too often these days? Like street preachers? You see, it's too cold in Chicago. I grew up in the South, so you get this on your street corners. So, truth is beautiful. And it's wonderful, but truth can't make an impact in people's lives if it can't be heard, right? That's the important lesson of Thomas More, is that the truth is great, but let's figure out how it can be heard. And Thomas More was a great study in how to be heard. So this is Christian eloquence. Christian eloquence isn't talking fancy or using fun words or throwing in as much Latin as possible, although it's okay. So it's what Christian eloquence is fitting how you speak to the audience in front of you so that the truth can be heard. That's it. So you can use salty language. Thomas More did that. When the Lutherans were making good impact on people using salty language, Thomas More has extremely offensive things written as a dialogue against the Lutherans. It's like, all right, if the merchants like that language, here's the Catholic Church. Anyway, so it's maybe not the best thing to introduce yourself with to Thomas More. So he matched his register to what was to his audience. And he was an expert in using humor. Humor is a very powerful tool in having the truth be heard. And More did this all the time. His favorite tool was parables. He told really funny parables about animals doing stupid things. And then when the person he's talking to stopped for a moment, they realized they're the stupid animal. Right? It's the exact same thing Nathan does for David, right? Oh, dear King David, right? Let me tell you about this rich man who had this big flock, but he still wanted this one sheep from this one poor person. Oh, yeah, Uriah, Bathsheba. Okay. It's a similar process, but More was perfect at helping people make better choices. He used his humor, he used his wit, he used his tact, he used his silence during the last years of his life. That is Christian eloquence. He never said anything about the marriage or the succession, but his silence spoke volumes. So he was trying to find the right, when you're dealing with an absolute monarch who can kill you for saying things that he doesn't like hearing, silence may be your only tool. And that's what Thomas More used, more or less, in what he was doing. So what is the point of good counsel is, to come back to the first slide, is to help people use their free will well. Right? It's not just to hear the truth. He's a humanist, mind you. So it's not just about knowing the truth. It's about living it too. And so he wants to help people to live out their faith. And that's the whole point of his good counsel. One of the, I think, an important lesson for us with Thomas More's wisdom is, well, the first step is, do we take the time to do that self-governance, right? Do we arm ourselves with the necessary tools and ask the hard questions so that we can come to that deep understanding of our free will and what it means to be a creature, in both the excellence of that and the limitations of that? Do we ask ourselves those questions? The other, coming back to the previous slide, knowing people, how well do we study other people? Do we know people through the lens of our own, the fantasies of our own making? Or do we try to learn about people in other ways, by watching them, by thinking about who they are as individuals? So knowing yourself helps you to know people better in both their excellence and their limitation. And then the one that's hardest, I think, with Thomas More is, okay, we all want to be the person who stands up on the chair and gives the good counsel, right? The harder question is, how good are we at receiving good counsel? Right? The wisdom of Thomas More, a part of the wisdom of Thomas More, is not how to give good counsel. It's don't be Henry, who refused good counsel. That's part of the wisdom of the story of Thomas More, is don't be a Henry VIII, who refused to receive Thomas More's good counsel. So one, I think, a good question for us to always think about, especially with the martyrs who stood up in kind of a way, like kind of a combination confessor-martyr, is, are we willing to listen? Are we willing to listen to other people provide us with good counsel? Or have we figured everything out already going forward? Okay. So what does this mean for Thomas More, the combination of these three themes? It means what I call him, he's a Christian realist. He wants to make the world a better place by helping people choose the good. And he knows precisely that they're going to resist it the whole way. He's just there, he's just hand on the rudder, just kind of gently nudging the rudder just a little bit until the sails are changed, right? Subtle, indirect influence. How does God work with Israel in the Old Testament? Slowly, subtly. It took 40 years in the desert just to get them to realize that he was God, after showing them walk through the Red Sea and the pillars of fire and cloud. But 40 years, little step-by-step nudging. The divine economy is extremely slow when it comes to making the world a better place. Until the eschaton, that'll be very fast. But it's very, very slow, the divine economy. Thomas More's vision for society models that for us. Make your world a little less bad. That's a goal we can all aspire to. And what's nice about that goal of make your world a little less bad is you don't get trapped in a fantasy of your own making, right? I'm going to make the world a better place. Who defines what better place is, right? So I'm just going to take the fantasy of my own making, and then it's going to fight with the fantasy of your making, and your making, and your making. But I think it's a little bit more concrete. Maybe I'm just deeply Augustinian and a pessimist. But maybe it's a little bit more inspiring and concrete to say, make the world a little less bad. And finally, don't care about your legacy on this. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to Thomas More's holiness or his wisdom that Henry VIII, the Tudor, didn't listen to him. It didn't matter to many of the saints that people didn't listen to them, because they are responding to God's counsel to them in their lives. So making the world a little bit less bad doesn't really matter one way or the other what your legacy is. If you think about doing good based on legacy, you're already starting to get trapped in the fantasy of your own making as well. So maybe it's a bit pessimistic, maybe it's a bit cynical, but for some reason, I wanted to share it with you because I find it deeply inspiring that Thomas More, with his last breath, was trying to make the world a little less bad. Thank you. So that's my part. But now, I can open up any questions, fights, challenges. I heard I have a historian in the room, so he can fight with me if he wants about it. So any Wolf Hall fans, you can leave. So, no one's read those books or watched that show, Wolf Hall? Good, all right, just stay away from that one. Yes?
What was the name of the movie that you said at the very beginning of your talk?
Man for All Seasons. Mm-hmm. It's an adaptation of Bolt's play, very famous, in the golden age of acting from the 60s. It's really good. One thing I'll say about Bolt, though, is Bolt makes Thomas More a man who defends the liberty of conscience. Thomas More does defend the integrity of conscience insofar as Thomas More defines conscience as that which is properly formed by all of Christendom and the tradition. Right, so it's not a modernist, individualist conscience. It is the conscience that's been formed by the rest of the church versus the particular, which is England. But Bolt is writing in the 60s. Well, actually, he writes before that, and the play is made in the 60s. So totalitarianism is very much on the forefront of people's minds, Nuremberg trial, stuff like that. So that's kind of the context for that one. Still a great movie, and it's a great play. Richard Rich didn't know Thomas More. So just, all right, I'll stop now. Historian, it's hard for historians to watch historical fiction. So it's, yeah, you agree? Okay, good. Yes?
But it was Richard Rich that testified falsely against.
Oh yeah, he perjured. But he's basically like the district attorney. He's just a courtier. He didn't really know Thomas More really well. But he was just like, should you lie? Yeah, okay, we're fine. So, but not what the play does and makes it into that yes, to sell your soul for whales. Yeah, it's a good line though. Any other questions, comments? Do you buy it that make the world less bad is a more noble vision than make the world a better place?
Yeah.
You can disagree with me, that's fine. I'm not grading you. I can't even grade him anymore, he's done.
So I guess applying More's ideas with something like the War of the Roses, which now we're not too far removed from at that point in history.
Yep.
More believed in that service to, or you know, improving society a little bit at a time. But
yep.
Split in society like that, how does he believe the individual uses their conscience to decide which side is like true and right?
Yep. Well, it's I guess his martyrdom kind of answers that, right? When push comes to shove, you have to give the ultimate witness on the side of truth and what's right in that particular case. But he's going to fight with every ounce of his wit all the way up to the end to try to get the reconciliation to occur. But at the end of the day, he has to choose to fight. He resigns. He fights the imperial ideology when it comes out. So this is not compromise for the sake of compromise. This is choose your battles, right? Pick your battles. Those of you that know small children, or if you have small children, you will learn that phrase really soon. So pick your battles, pick your battles. But yeah, England has come out of the War of the Roses, so it's, Henry thinks he needs a male heir, but then gets two female, after Edward, he's got two female daughters who reigned, so it was never a need in the first place. But Henry's operating as if the world can be decided based on whatever he wants. He's also the king, so his world kind of can operate the way he wants it. So that's the danger of a king is never tell a king how much authority he has. If you're a good courtier for Thomas More, he's like, never let the lion know how powerful he is the way he expresses it. But, yes?
So I guess I'm thinking with kind of the make the world less bad, did Thomas More have any interest in, I guess, I just think because there's a lot of people, I guess, maybe that lean more politically left that talk about kind of structural changes or institutional changes, politically speaking, which is kind of not really making the world less bad, but kind of getting rid of these systems that they perceive, whether correctly or not, the cause of these problems. So did Thomas More have any interest in changing, like, the fundamental structure of anything in this society? Or?
No. Not really.
Not even privately?
Privately he wanted representational governance. So he actually petitioned King Henry and got freedom of speech for the House of Commons. So he really believed in representational governance and fought for freedom of speech. Why? So that there's more opportunity for good counsel. That's why you have freedom of speech. So he really believed representational governance was way better than monarchy. But monarchy's what he's got, so let's make it less bad. Because he's a Christian humanist, and so the root of all solutions to societal problems is people being better Christians, people using their free will well. And so that's the solution for social difficulties. It's people using their will better. It kind of tips his hand that utopia means nowhere, right? That's his perfect society. He solves the problem of private property, of lots of different issues in the utopian text, in a totalitarian, nightmarish way. The social problems are all solved. It's perfect equality, perfect equity, everything is happy. But it's extremely oppressive society. But it's nowhere, right? And so it's a foil. I don't know, it's hard to say with Thomas More. You can kind of go back and forth.
Was he entirely just in the world of kind of politics, or did he go out into culture, or any kind of realms?
He was in what the humanists referred to as the Republic of Letters. So they would share letters back and forth, they would publish things. Think of it as a very small blogosphere that only had about 100 participants in it, right? That's the humanist kind of Republic of Letters. Important thinkers that were trying to influence each other. That's where he walked. That's where Utopia was successful. That's where his translations of Lucian in particular are really important. So he's at that high level of cultural elite. But he also does the dirty work of, or the laborious work of service to the state. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to believe me. But what I will say is, if you're interested in more about Thomas More, all right, try not to make that, and it's all the time. I can't, too many mores in sentences. Okay, if you're interested in Thomas and would like to explore his thought further, the website that I pulled his final prayer from on the handout, that has tons of primary sources on it. It's curated by a bunch of great Thomas More scholars. Travis Cartwright, Gerald Wegemer as well, has been involved in that. A lot of free resources there. If you are looking for great spiritual reading, the Tower works, in particular the Sadness of Christ and the Dialogue of Consolation, the Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation. Those are the two works that really bring out kind of a lot of what I was just touching the surface of. His kind of deep understanding about the cosmos and how the world works. Those come out really clear in those texts. They make good Lenten readings. Sadness of Christ is short. If you really need, but the Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation is good as well. But it really is, I think, a challenge for all of us with Thomas More's life is, can we be realistic in helping to make things less bad? Or in other words, can we actually be the creatures we are called to be and say yes to God's will in the way that God wants us to say yes, rather than being trapped and ending up like Henry VIII? Any other questions? There's handouts for anyone. If you have any other further questions, I can always be reached at the seminary. philliard@usml.edu is my email. So I'm a resource of the Archdiocese of Chicago, so I'm always happy to help. So thanks for your attention, and you've been a lovely captive audience. So you get a little sense of what it's like to be captive for many years, you know, in my classes. So good, very good.